Today on Against the Grain, our capitalist world seems mired in crisis, beset by low growth and instability. Emmanuel Wallerstein argues that the current malaise goes beyond the periodic fluctuations of the business cycle. According to him, capitalism's days are numbered. In 20 to 40 years, it will be gone. What replaces it may be something better or something worse. I'm Sasha Lilly. Wallerstein will join me to talk about the end of capitalism, as well as resistance to Donald Trump and the recent attack on Syria. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Capitalism appears to be a permanent fixture in our world, as chaotic and unequal as it is. We're told that there's no alternative to it, and any attempts to get rid of it will end badly. But my guest today argues that in the next 2 to 4 decades, capitalism will be gone. What replaces it has everything to do with the strength of the forces of right and left. To talk about the end of capitalism, I'm joined by sociologist Emmanuel Wallerstein. He's the father of world systems analysis and senior research scholar at Yale University. His many books include the multi-volume Modern World System, and he's a contributor to the recent work, Does Capitalism Have a Future? Emmanuel, let's talk about where we got to where we are now. It's so easy to focus on the particulars of Trump in the American context, but far-right, quasi-populist politics have found significant support elsewhere in the world, especially in Europe. What were the forces that took us to this place? What has risen and what has been displaced?
We, all of us, have been operating within the framework of what I call the modern world system, which is a capitalist world economy and has been in existence for 400 to 500 years. It was originally in a relatively small part of the world, Western, Northern Europe, and parts of the Americas. It expanded by its internal processes till it englobed the entire Earth. That structure is the structure which was the basis of our lives and within which we operated. It was a historical system, meaning by system that it's something that is stable and repetitious, and historical meaning it changes at every millisecond. So that's it's not a contradiction, it's a reality. You have to take that reality and live with it. So now, like all systems, whether we're talking of the universe as a whole, or the most micro system that you can think of, it has a life. It comes into existence. It has what I think of as its normal life, and because of its internal processes, it comes to a point where it can no longer operate and renew itself in its proper way. And we call that a structural crisis. And a structural crisis is not a crisis of a second. It's a crisis of quite a long time. And when you're in a structural crisis of the world system, which is what we are in, there's a bifurcation. By a bifurcation, technically, what physicists mean by a bifurcation is that there are two solutions to the same equation. Something theoretically impossible, but in fact occurs. And it makes it a fork. You can move in one direction or the other direction. And while at one, you can't know which way the thing will end up going, you can, in fact, affect it enormously. So that's where we are. We're in the structural crisis of the modern world system. The structural crisis of the modern world system is by definition, highly chaotic. By chaotic, you mean it swings wildly in all directions, right, at all times. So that's extremely confusing. And people don't know how to handle it, but they do. They handle it one way or the other. And now people are talking about the neoliberal effects and the, shall we say, the right-wing populism, etc. All that are responses, modes of responding to this crisis, how people handle it in various ways. And this crisis, however, is poses itself as a struggle, between people who would like to move the hand, who would like to strengthen one prong of the outcome. So what are the prongs? And I created names for them, but names are unimportant. For me, one is the spirit of Davos, and one is the spirit of Porto Alegre. And what do I mean by that? The spirit of Davos are those people who have accepted the reality that capitalism no longer works for capitalists and want to replace it with another system which has all the worst features of capitalism and perhaps could be even worse than capitalism, right? That's the spirit of Davos. And the spirit of Porto Alegre is the spirit of those people who would like a system that has never existed in the history of the world, which is one that is relatively egalitarian and relatively democratic. So there we are. We're pushing in these two different directions. Now, when people talk of what to do about it, what I say to them is, of course, you do those things which will push you in many ways to in the direction of the spirit of Porto Alegre. And the problem is even more confusing than that, because in each of these two prongs, there are two versions of what you do. In the spirit of Davos, one version is the way we powerful people could handle this challenge is to hit the others over the head and hit them as hard as possible, right? And they will quiet down and we will have our way. And there's another group who says that won't work because when people are hit over the head, they resist even more. And what you have to do is you have to follow the path of de Lampedusa what was the name of his book?
The Leopard?
Of course. The protagonist says to his very conservative grandfather, we must change everything in order that nothing change, right? So you have to persuade people that they are changing when they are not really changing. So they are split. And on the side of the spirit of Porto Alegre, there are those who say what we have to do is create a situation in which everybody does their own thing and tries to listen to each other. It's called horizontalism, right? And because if you have a vertical structure with control, you are in fact not going to change the system. And that's the horizontalist. And the verticalist says that's very well, that's all well and good, but in fact, at that point, you'll be hit over the head by those other guys and you won't get anywhere. So instead of two positions, we have four positions. And that's even more confusing.
Sure.
And then, so today, some people are saying, well, what we should do is resist. I'm all for resistance. But what does it mean to resist? See.
Indeed. And I want to ask you more about the conundrum, and you're describing it from above and from below. So getting to this moment of crisis and then what comes out of the crisis and the contending ideas, let's just say on the left and on the right for that moment.
I'm happy to say the left and the right. I have no trouble with that.
All right. But let me talk to you before we get to those competing forces and questions. Let's talk about the nature of that crisis. So you're not talking about a crisis that just developed over the last couple years. You're talking about something deeper. And I wonder if you could tell us when you see the crisis of the modern world system beginning, and what's the nature of the crisis? You alluded to it. You said that the conditions for the renewal of the system have been impeded in some way.
Well, the way the system got renewed always is that, it operated in terms of cyclical rhythms that went up and down, except that's how we think of them. But in fact, if you look at it carefully, they went up and then level and then up and then level, okay? Well, if you do that and you begin to measure what's happening, at a certain point, you get pretty close to the top. You go up and level. If the vertical axis is a percentage of something, for example, the percentage of people who are earning wage labor or so forth, and you go up and then level, then you get to a point where you can't go up anymore because you're approaching the asymptote. And it seems the estimate of people who do these analyses is that when you reach about the 80% point, you begin to shake. and when you begin to shake, instead of, a big change resulting in a big thrust resulting in very little change, it becomes a little change results in very big change, okay? So what basically happened is that the mechanisms which enabled capitalists to make their profits have reached this point of shaking, they aren't guaranteed any longer the possibility of profits, or they're not guaranteed the perspective of making more, and therefore most people think that a crisis like this is only because the people in the bottom are unhappy. The people in the bottom have always been unhappy, so to speak. What's added to that is that the people on top are unhappy as well. That's new. That's the crisis. That caused the crisis. When did this? I date it from the early 1970s onward, more or less, as this period in which we are in this, what I call in one of my books, hell on earth, because it's so devastating. We don't know what is going to happen in the short run, in the middle run, and so forth, and we find ourselves extremely frustrated by the wild swings that occur. So
now, and is this unhappiness from the top evenly distributed around the world system? That is, are the conditions of reproduction of capitalism equally a problem?
But capitalism has always been a world system. It's never the idea that capitalism exists in a country is a mad idea. It has no reality whatsoever. So if I am a capitalist located in country X, my inputs and my potential sales are calculated in terms of the world system as a whole, right? So when you say, is it all evenly distributed, the negative effects may be greater or less in one part of the world or another, but in terms of the system as a whole, it's the people on top who are not able to make the kinds of be assured of the kinds of profits that they have been, and therefore look for alternative ways of retaining the kind of unequal income that they have profited from for several hundred years. And that's where we are.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with renowned sociologist Emmanuel Wallerstein. So in terms of thinking about how we got to this moment and the forces that have produced this crisis, and I do want to talk to you quite a bit more about thinking ahead beyond this moment, but just staying with this moment, you were talking about different cycles that take place and the intrinsic problems that happen along the course of the cycle. And I wanted to ask you more about that. How should we think of history moving in cycles? What constitute these cycles? And I know you write about more than one kind of cycle, but how should someone who hasn't thought about any of this in cyclical terms understand what may seem like a whole lot of economic chaos as being cyclical?
Well, all of life is a series of cycles. It's just a question of which are the sort of most important ones or the most have the most effect on our lives. But, you know, think of it as breathing. You breathe in and you breathe out. You breathe in and you breathe out. There's no way of not having a cycle in that sense. The question is, and that is what happens when you breathe out as opposed to breathing in and so forth. So that's the idea of having this step. Okay? So there are some things into which we put a great deal of effort. We have cycles that have to do with the economy. They have a name too. They're called Kondratiev cycles, right? And what seems to happen is that the economy expands steadily for roughly 25, 30 years. And then it can't expand anymore. Why? Because the way the economy expands in a capitalist system is you have relative monopolies. You can't make money if you don't have a relative monopoly. But relative monopolies are self-liquidating for a whole series of reasons. One reason is if you have a good thing going, right, then other people want to get in on it. And there are various ways of getting in on it. And if enough of them get in on it, then they're no longer as profitable as they were. And that's when you have to pull back. And all I'm saying is when you pull back for various reasons, you don't pull all the way back because it's the resistance to pulling back also exists. So the compromise is to be more or less stable for another 25 to 30, 40. These numbers are arbitrary, but they're real. I mean, we can measure Kondratiev's over 500 years and see that the A phase and B phase, the expansion and the contraction phase, have been on the whole 50 to 60 years combined. Okay. And until they reach the point that they can no longer operate. So that's one major cycle. And a second major cycle is the geopolitical cycle. One of the important things about capitalism as a system is you need a kind of relative stability in the geopolitics of the world system in order that people can create those monopolies. So in order to create a monopoly in the economic sphere, you have to create a monopoly of geopolitical power. Those are even harder to create, but we've had, in my view, three of them historically, which I can name in terms of the zone that was on top of the system at a given point was first was the United Provinces, which is what we now, which we now call the Kingdom of the Netherlands, or the Netherlands plus Belgium. And then there's the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and then there was the United States, always united, but that's a small point. And what happened is after the Second World War, after 1945, we entered into the most extensive monopoly, Kondratiev cycle that we had ever had, so that it went further up and more extensively than prior to that. And at the same time, it was the high point of the geopolitical cycle with the U.S. as the dominant power. Now, what happens is, therefore, that we have the biggest of each of these, and they both begin their downturn circa the 1970s. So it's the biggest, and then it's the, how should I say, the biggest difficulty. And that's how we enter into this situation in which we are today, and which we don't know the outcome. It's intrinsically impossible to predict the outcome because it is a function of an infinity of many of micro actions and micro moments at micro levels, right? But we can't predict, but because it's, how should I say, so chaotic, we can affect it. Because during the normal previous couple of hundred years, what would happen is we would put in enormous social energy into changing things, and very little would happen. I usually use as my examples both the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution. The French Revolution was in an incredible input of effort to change the system. And if you just look at it in terms of where we are, not in 1789, but in 1850 or 1873, we had basically moved back considerably. So that the change, the real change, was very little. The same with the Russian Revolution, an immense input. And when you look at it in 1970 or so, and you say, how much has really changed? It turns out that very little has really changed.
So what you're suggesting, if I understand you correctly, is that although there are these cycles that we can see over periods of time, that these don't necessarily then predetermine the kinds of changes that happen at these junctures.
Absolutely don't predetermine it at all. They just predetermine the fact that we are in a crisis where every mini action affects us. And that's what brings us then to resist, right? The concept of resist is a concept that says, oh, goodness, these right-wing forces are basically strong everywhere, my country and in other countries and so forth, and they're reinforcing each other. What can we do about it? And the answer is resist. But resistance also, there's a problem with resist. It's a question of temporality. There's what I call the short run and the middle run. Turns out that people live in the short run. We have to eat every day. We have to sleep every day, right? We have to survive every day. So we're very concerned with what happens today. And today is a period maybe of a maximum of 3 years. A capitalist entrepreneur who invests his money, he has a perspective. His perspective is, can I make my basic money back within 3 years. Otherwise, who knows? I can't predict further than that. If I can't expect to make it back in 3 years, I'm not going to invest. Okay? So what is happening is that people have to worry about the short term, and a movement that attempts to move them cannot ignore these things. So they have to do things that will help people in the short run. I call that minimizing the pain. You can do things. You can try to pass a bill through a legislature. You can try. There are all kinds of ways in which you can try to move things in the short run. And you can succeed, perhaps. You can minimize the pain by increasing the amount of redistribution here or there. But minimizing the pain is not transforming the system. That's the point to remember. Minimizing the pain is minimizing the pain. And it's a good thing to do, but it isn't changing the system. And changing the system requires a kind of, minimizing the pain requires compromises with all sorts of people. Lesser evil kind of idea. But the medium term with transforming the system requires quite the opposite, requires saying it's you've got to move in this direction. There's no compromise with the other direction. So that's, again, the problem of the movements, of resisting. Are they thinking about the short term, or are they thinking about the middle term, or do they know how to think about them both simultaneously? Well, it ain't easy. That's the real point. None of this is easy, right? And we all make mistakes all over the place. Looking back on what we've done 100 years from now, people will say, my God, why did they do X? That was so stupid. We should have done Y. Yeah, but that's 100 years from now, looking back, and we're in the middle of it. So we can make mistakes all over the place. And all I can say is try your best. Do what you can. Resist by minimizing the pain. Resist by not compromising with the other side whatsoever. And hope. It's in effect, you hope that all of this adds up. Because what happens with the bifurcation is at one point or another, enough forces are on one side rather than the other so that it tilts, and that side becomes the new system.
That's the voice of sociologist Emmanuel Wallerstein. We'll take a music break and be back with him. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with sociologist Emmanuel Wallerstein. His many books include The Multi-Volume Modern World System. He's senior research scholar at Yale University, and my name is Sasha Lilly. So you've been talking about your prediction that in 20 to 40 years approximately from now, that the crisis that we're already in, the crisis of the modern world system, is going to come to a head in some way, and in a sense echoing Rosa Luxemburg's notion of socialism or barbarism, it could either go in a positive anti-capitalist direction or a very negative direction that would be not capitalism, but potentially something worse. What does that bleakest option, how might you envisage that looking? The worst case scenario.
The worst case scenario, I think the worst case scenario is simply that we have a new system which is inegalitarian and undemocratic, but which is, how shall I say, solidly based, begins its own process of whatever the rules they set up. The normal period of a system is the system operating by the rules they invent, right? And you can't know what all the rules are that you can't predict what all the rules are that they will invent. For example, I often say, look, suppose we were sitting around a table in the year 1450, 1500, and we said to each other, boy, this feudal system in Western Europe is coming to an end for X, Y, and Z reasons. So let's create a new one. We'll call it capitalism. And here are the kinds of institutions which we'll need to set up. Do you really think that anybody sitting in 1450 or 1500 could imagine all the structures that would get created? And the answer is, of course, obviously not, because these structures come into existence in the process of the operation of the system. So if you ask me what the system will look like, I can't tell you. I can only tell you, right, whether it is tends to be inegalitarian, hierarchical, polarizing. That's what we now have or what we're coming out of, or whether it's relatively egalitarian and relatively democratic. Again, I say relatively because nothing is perfectly anything, but we can do a lot better than we've ever done before. And I want to emphasize that there's never been a case, none of these so-called past socialist or blah, blah systems of various kinds were, in fact, relatively egalitarian, relatively democratic. So it isn't a question of trying to revive one of those systems. It's trying to create a system which the world has never known but is theoretically possible.
Would you think of the worst case scenario, and perhaps not the worst case scenario, I'm not sure, as both being forms of class society? Would it be fair to say that the bleakest option of all would be some form of class society, just not this one, and the other form would transcend that?
They would be a class society, of course, but in the sense that they would be hierarchical, right? And they would be exploitative, and they would be polarizing. So they get worse and worse as time goes on. So you want to call that a class society? I'm perfectly happy with the language, as long as we know what we're talking about, right? The problem with all our languages is they're all so laden over with historical usages that almost always I have to wonder when somebody says something to me what they mean by it. And I have to try to read into, or how shall I say, figure out what people mean by using a word like class society. But I have no objection to it. I would call that a class society, sure.
So what would crucially be different then, just staying with the most sort of odious possibility for how society might go coming out of this crisis, how the world system would go, what would not continue? I mean, you talked about hierarchy and polarization and exploitation, which are all hallmarks of capitalism. But there obviously have been societies that have been hierarchical and exploitative that haven't been capitalists, obviously. And you've written that you see capitalism as a system of accumulation without end. Is that what would be fundamentally changed in a society that was, let's just say, highly reactionary but not capitalist?
And that's an interesting question. I'm not sure I know the answer to that. The endless accumulation of capital is my defining feature of a capitalist system. So if you had a non-capitalist system, that was nonetheless exploitative and so forth, would they center around the endless accumulation of capital? They might not. They might not. I can't know exactly how they would organize things, except that they would organize it such that the outcome was exploitation. The outcome was hierarchy, but structurally, I would doubt it, as a matter of fact, because I think that's a defining feature of the capitalist system. It would not necessarily be the defining feature of another kind of awful system.
But you, of course, are also arguing that this is not the only way things could go, and that there is an opening, a possibility of moving beyond capitalism in a more...
That's right.
Egalitarian way. Now, I know that you've just said that we can't look into a crystal ball and picture a society that goes entirely beyond whatever we've experienced, but do you have, when you suggest that there's this sort of Porto Alegre avenue, let's just say, at its base, are there things that you imagine would be essential in terms of getting beyond capitalism?
Well, you know, I kind of believe in the human imagination. And what that kind of situation would do would be to release the human imagination to thinking about how they could maintain a system, maintain it as relatively egalitarian and relatively democratic, because there would always be people within it who would try to undo that. You know, they speak in, especially in Latin America, they speak of Buen Vivir, which is itself a translation of an Aymara word and of a Quechua word, and it means to live well. But what does that mean in English? It doesn't mean anything per se, but what they try to mean by it is that there would be some kind of human interaction of people that would try to see what way we could choose something that would end up being more egalitarian or more democratic, so that it would require a constant kind of discussion that would not rule out possibilities. Now, this is in my, if the spirit of Porto Alegre wins, right? So I see it as an open society, as one that permits you to think of new possibilities all the time, present them to others, defend them, amend them, and release your imagination. I think that's very important as an idea, and which you find very strongly argued by somebody like Ilya Prigozhin in terms of the structure of the world that could be made, could be created.
Well, I realize I'm sort of pushing you to take the very long view with some of these questions, but you had mentioned that, and you've written that capitalism is a system and hence has a beginning but also an end. In thinking about life beyond capitalism and thinking about the more egalitarian path beyond capitalism, should we also think about whatever comes next as also having a life cycle?
Well, you know, it's quite, in a sense, any system has a life cycle, by definition. Right? Any system has a life cycle. But I do know someone who argues that we are going to move into a relatively egalitarian one, and then after about 500 years, we will move. He sees a cycle of moving between these two back and forth. I'm not ready to say that. I'm not ready to say that. I don't know that. That's, how shall I say, he has a cyclical process beyond my cyclical process, okay? And he may be right. He may be right. Or he may be wrong. How can I'm not trying to be evasive. I'm trying to give people a realistic idea of what their options are and what their best choices are in a difficult situation.
Emmanuel Wallerstein is my guest. He is the noted sociologist. Amongst his many books, he's a contributor to Does Capitalism Have a Future? I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I was wondering if you think there are any danger in making grand predictions about the future, including that capitalism will be replaced by something worse or better in 20 to 40 years. Are there pitfalls in doing so, especially if the prediction doesn't, end up coming to pass?
There is a danger. And the danger is that people will think it's hopeless and they will retreat into a shell, in a sense. And they will then not be active. And by not being active and not resisting either in the short run or the middle run, they more or less guarantee, in a sense, that the other side will win. So I do worry that anything that I say will persuade people that they will reduce their willingness to push in the right direction. There's also the danger my arguments can be used against me by people who are not on my side. I have been told, they are now quoting you to say we are right, and so forth. So yes, it's a danger, and yes, I worry about it, and yes, I do what I can. That's in the end, I do what I can, and I'm urging everybody to do what they can.
Well, in the time that we have remaining, let's talk about that struggle to fight, in essence, the good fight, to influence things in one direction and rather than another in the midst of crisis. To what degree does how we understand the world, to what degree is that the terrain of struggle? In thinking about particularly the forces of the left, if we want to call them that, or radicalism, there has been in many quarters, a real rejection of the universalisms of the left of the past, and in many ways, a focus on the particular against such a thing. And I wonder if that turn leaves us in any way in any kind of quandary, and particularly in terms of the kind of struggle that you're talking about to influence the direction that things go in the future, obviously, is a tremendous struggle. Well, and so does that need some kind of way of unifying people beyond the particular?
Well, I respond to that kind of question the way I respond to a lot of other questions, which is the impossible is the most possible. The impossible is to be simultaneously universalist and particularist. As it's the impossible is to be both structural and historic. And we have to learn how to do that. And that is not easy. So I I can only again say, of course, you have to be. The simplistic universalisms were part of the dominant intellectual structure of the capitalist world system, the binary splits that all sorts of people in the last 10, 20, 30 years have been denouncing. They're right. Those were terrible. To go to the other extreme and say, therefore, always be particularist, there's no end to that. If you're particularist, your particularism is within the particularism, and at the end, you're left with absolutely nothing. If you follow particularism to the end of the stream, everything is disintegrated. And so it's helpless, and then the other side can just walk in. So how can you be both universalist, that is to say analytic, okay, which I'm trying to be, and take into account particularisms, which I'm trying to do, both in the short run and in the middle run, right? And again, let me say it's not easy.
Let me end by asking you about this particular moment that we happen to be in. You've been stressing a much longer view and the culmination of forces over a longer span of time. But we do find ourselves in a moment where the far right is in power in this country, and much has been discredited. Yet, in terms of what replaces what's been discredited is still very up in the air. Do you see that there are openings right now, both in terms of domestic politics in the United States and then also the question of U.S. Sure. imperial ambitions, which were sort of on display recently with the Trump's attack on Syria, which was sort of a fascinating moment because, of course, some people had held on to the hope of a silver lining with far-right populist kind of isolationism against the hawkishness of Clinton, and it seems like we now have the worst of all possible worlds.
I wouldn't give up the silver lining yet.
You don't think so?
No. I think we have a man in power named Donald G. Trump, or G, is it G? Forgotten, J. Trump. Anyway, Donald Trump, who had the astuteness to combine being the head of a social movement and being the candidate of a political party. Basically, his power has resided in combining the two, which no one ever did before, basically, or never successfully. Now that he is the president of the United States, with all the technical power that that gives him and control of various things like armies and so forth, he still wants to be the head of a movement because his power in the United States comes not from being president of the United States or the head of the Republican Party. His power comes from the fact that he has a movement which is behind him and which follows him or seems to follow him for the time being, no matter what he does. I mean, he himself said that I could shoot somebody on Broadway. I could shoot somebody in the middle of the street and they still would follow me, right? And in a sense, he was absolutely right. Now, he hasn't given that up. And Syria is a good example. What has happened? Well, he's been under pressure from all sorts of sides to bomb somebody, okay? At a certain moment, not too long ago, he gave the order, bomb, okay? And since he's the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, they bombed. And then what? Well, everybody says, well, what next? Okay, so he has all sorts of people who are presumably in his cabinet, in his inner circle, and in this, making statements about what our policy is, not what it should be, what it is. And it turns out they're making different statements. And everybody's making a statement except one person. That one person is Donald Trump. So he isn't making a statement. We don't know what next. What we do know is he will decide what next, but on what basis? And we don't know. And in fact, this uncertainty is part of his power. So I don't know, you don't know, whether he's going to send more troops in or not send more troops in. He loses whatever he does. That's the reality of the situation. But that doesn't mean he won't do something terribly stupid or stupid, something which will have consequences which are so negative that the world will bemoan it, right? Because he could do that. I give him a lot of credit for, how shall I say, I don't think he's stupid. I don't think he's ignorant. I think he's very astute, and I think he's, how shall I say, feeling out the world and trying to figure out what he could do that would be the least harmful to him in his power and the United States as its power. Well, okay, fine, but I don't know what that is, by the way. And I don't know that he's going to find out what that is. So he may do nothing. That will not be good for him either. He's got a lose-lose situation. The one thing I'm not sure of is if he recognizes that he's in a lose-lose situation, or he thinks somehow that he can still get on top of it. So.
Well, on that cheery note, Emmanuel Wallerstein, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with the sociologist Emmanuel Wallerstein. He is senior research scholar at Yale University, author of scores of books, including Decline of American Power and Uncertain Worlds. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.